the main body of this episode of Spoiler Master Podcast will be health in English, after a brief introduction in Polish. Witam Was serdecznie w Spoiler Masterze, z tej strony Michał Oleszczyk. To jest odcinek bonusowy, nie należący do głównego nurtu odcinków Spoiler Masterowych. Powstały z potrzeby chwili. Serdecznie dziękuję Julii Jędrysik, bez której nie byłoby tego odcinka. To ona zwróciła moją uwagę na obecność w Warszawie Andrew Sodrowskiego, amerykańskiego scenarzysty, który podpisał i był nominowany do Nagrody Gildii Scenarzystów za znakomity miniserial Manhunt Una Bomber, a obecnie czekamy na premierę jego filmu pełnometrażowego Holland, Michigan ze scenariuszem Andrew Sodrowskiego i w reżyserii Mimi Cave w rolach głównych Nicole Kidman, Matthew McFadden i wielu innych, także Gael Garcia Bernal. Bardzo dziękuję raz jeszcze Julii za to, że przedstawiła mnie Andrew, a owocem jest ten odcinek, w którym usiedliśmy w warszawskim Studio Plac i porozmawialiśmy o konstrukcji i postaciach w scenariuszu Paula Schradera do filmu Taksówkarz Martina Scorsese. Przypominam, że o taksówkarzu możecie posłuchać osobnego Spoilermastera. To był odcinek z trzeciego sezonu o numerze 21. A zatem odsyłam tam, a teraz już przechodzimy do rozmowy o jednym z najsłynniejszych scenariuszy świata. Dodam jeszcze, że w przygotowaniu jest polskie tłumaczenie tej rozmowy. Tekst polski rozmowy z Andrew Sodrowskim otrzymają wkrótce wszystkie patronki i patroni mojego podcastu wspierający mnie dowolną kwotą w serwisie patronite.pl/spoilermaster. My guest today is Andrew Sodrowski. Hello, Andrew.
Hi.
Very, very nice to see you and wonderful to have you on the podcast. I know that this is the first podcast that you are doing.
Is
that correct?
Okay. Yeah, that's my first ever.
This is the first Spoiler Master episode that I devote to specifically to the art of screenwriting. And I couldn't possibly dream of a better guest today. Andrew is an author of a script of a film that actually will premiere later in the year. It's called Holland, Michigan, and it stars Nicole Kidman. I'm looking forward to that film, and also I'm a huge fan of Andrew's work on Manhunt Unabomber, which was a Discovery Channel production that premiered in 2018 and got Andrew a nomination for Writers Guild of America Award. So congratulations on that, and looking forward to the new film. You are on strike right now, right? We are in July 2023.
Yep, I am on strike right now. Which How is great, because I get to do things like this. I don't have to feel guilty about not working.
Well, we support the strike that's going on. It actually, as we speak, in July of 2023, it reached pretty historic proportions, I would say, with the Guild of Actors joining as well. So good luck, and hopefully this will bring about the desired change. In the meantime, as you said, you have time to maybe to revisit some of the films that shaped you as a writer and that you admire. I know that the movie that we'll talk about today definitely is a movie like that. You suggested the title. It's Taxi Driver, the Martin Scorsese film, written by Paul Schrader. My first question to you will be, and thank you so much for suggesting the title, because it is one of my favorites too. What was your first encounter with this film like? Do you remember the circumstances? How old were you? And what was the initial feel that you had after the first encounter with Travis Bickle?
Yeah, good question. I know that for me, I think I first saw the film sometime late in high school or early in college. And I remember being not getting it the first time, and maybe even the second time. And then I went to film school at Columbia in New York. And as soon as I had the feeling of going around in New York and being a tiny little ant in the giant anthill of totally indifferent, horrible, slimy, disgusting New York City. Then I started to get it. Mm, and then it was okay. Like, oh, it really clicked. And that's the time when I started watching it over and over and over again and really trying to understand, like, how does this work? And for me, Travis Bickle was just like a magnetic field. Mm-hmm. That kept coming back, or like a black hole that right. kept bringing me in. Uh-huh. That way of seeing the world and that way of moving through the world and that the anger mm-hmm. and the displacement and the loneliness, it was all stuff that, I mean, I felt that I was feeling all that stuff and I was watching it mirrored on screen and I was watching it kind of spew into violence and like, it was very, very meaningful for me to be able to have that film to go to as a mirror of my own experiences.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Which year was that? When did you attend Columbia?
That would have been 2005, I think I started.
Okay.
2005 to 2010.
So it was no longer, let's say, the New York that we see on the screen,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it was already, uh-huh. It was all cleaned gentrified. Up and nice. Yeah. Uh-huh. But the feeling, I don't know, for whatever reason, the inner uh-huh. landscape of that New York for me was very much there. Like right. the alienation and the kind of grime of it was there.
Okay, okay. Let's focus on Travis for a bit. Also on the ways in which Paul Schrader introduces him in the text itself. Because mm-hmm. today I would like us to focus probably more on the screenplay itself, although, you know, the movie will always be there in the background. But just, I'm trying to imagine what was it like for the first readers of the script, which included, we know, Brian De Palma, Robert Mulligan, who was supposed to direct at the beginning, and of course, Martin Scorsese. What was it like for them to grasp this character for the first time? And the first thing that I noticed on this when I reread the script is how many contradictions there are to Travis, but yeah. also to the way that Schrader describes him. He will describe him sometimes as completely disarming with his smile, and there is a point in the script where he actually refers to him as a psychopath. He says he is a psychopath, mm-hmm. right? So there are those very, very contradictory, different words and ways of describing Travis. What does stand out for you from a screenwriter's point of view yeah. in this text regarding how the character of Travis is described?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, for me, the key to, you know, the thing that makes this a great film and a great character is that Travis is a walking contradiction and that he has within himself both the desire to fit in and have a relationship and be part of society and also like a total hatred of that and disgust at that. But at the same time, the life of the outsider he finds disgusting and gross, and he wants the rain to come and wash it all away, you know. And yet he himself is sort of wallowing in that life. And mm-hmm. I think, like, what for me, and this is something I always look for when I'm creating characters. Also, it's like Travis has this thing in himself, these two competing desires at work all the time in himself, and so that inner tension is just driving him forward all the time. It makes him an engine of conflict in any scene that he walks into. So in any scenario that he goes into, he creates conflict because mm-hmm. he simultaneously wants to be the outsider coming in to cleanse the world of all this shit that he sees, and also to be an insider in the political machine. Mm-hmm. You know, he wants to mm-hmm. either join the senator's team or kill the senator. wants them both at the same time, and neither one will make him happy. And mm-hmm. that's what makes him just an animal.
Right. Right. So he, on one hand, when he is confronted with the senator in the cab, he says, I'm your fan. I'm your, you know, I tell everyone to vote for you. So he yeah. wants to sort of like ingratiate himself.
Yes.
But at the same time, he will, you know, he starts this sort of assassination plan, right?
Yeah. Yeah, when he's trying to figure out what one thing can I do that's going to give my life meaning, the first thing he comes up with is killing the very senator he was sucking up to not that long ago in the film. And it's like this, it's raison d'etre, right, what Dostoevsky talked about, where it's like you both desire the thing and hate the object of your desire. And what's so nice about that as a writer is that once you find that, you can put that character in any scenario and he just makes trouble. Mm-hmm. He makes conflict. Mm-hmm.
Can you give me some examples in the text, in the scenes? I'm thinking of small details like behavior or relationship that Travis has to his surroundings or objects. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that stands out specifically for you as a good example of this sort of contradictory way of being?
I think the first moment in the film, and this is so cool, seeing it again just this last time, it just struck me so strongly. The moment you know this is gonna be a great character is when you're in the he gets the job as a taxi driver. Then he goes to his apartment. He's in his apartment. He's writing in his journal, and he's saying, you know, some days I wish that a rain would come just wash all this trash and this filth. The city is so disgusting. I'm getting headaches. While you're panning over his apartment, and you're seeing his apartment is full of trash and it's disgusting. Right. It's horrible, and he's got a bottle of schnapps and his, you know, amphetamines on the table next to him as he's writing, and it's like and that's it. That's the whole thing is in that contrast between what he's saying and the way he's living.
That's interesting what you're saying, because I often when I read scripts in whatever capacity, this is the first thing that I'm looking for is the element of tension, right? Of something, but not necessarily in like Hitchcockian suspense. It's not like, oh, you know, there's going to be this horrible thing that will happen. More like, oh, this character says one thing but does the other, right? Yep. This would be something along those lines.
Yeah, well, that's the inner tension of Travis, and that's what drives the film. And that's what makes it, you know, the film, like, I don't know if there is until the middle, I don't know if there is a big Hitchcockian tension to the film in terms of like a dramatic question, a single dramatic question that drives you through. But it's just this guy is split in half, and watching how he tries to resolve that inner split is why you keep watching.
Right. I think the split also translates nicely into this sort of his day life and his night life, you know, like that he's a different creature in the daylight and a different creature in, you know, during the night, because the guy that Betsy sees when he finally introduces himself at the Palatine office is a presentable young man, even a little bit charming as Schrader, you know, says here in the script. But that's not the guy who's driving the taxi at night, right?
It's like the difference between that blazer, the red velvet blazer, and the jacket with King Kong Company on the shoulder. Right, you know, these two Travises, and how do you reconcile the two of them?
Right. I will just read the first paragraph of the screenplay, because it's quite a remarkable description of Travis.
It's like the best character description ever written.
I agree. So let's just listen to it. So Travis Bickle, age 26, lean, hard, the consummate loner. On the surface, he appears good-looking, even handsome. He has a quiet, steady look and a disarming smile which flashes from nowhere, lighting up his whole face. But behind that smile, around his dark eyes, in his gaunt cheeks, one can see the ominous strains caused by a life of private fear, emptiness, and loneliness. He seems to have wandered in from a land where there is always cold, a country where the inhabitants seldom speak. The head moves, the expression changes, but the eyes remain ever fixed, unblinking, piercing, empty space.
Ah, that's amazing. Right? It's so good. It's so good. Right? And also, like, man, what actor doesn't want to play that character?
Exactly.
Just like it's one
But the whole
paragraph.
Movie is here, basically, right? Like that he wandered in from this strange land.
Yeah.
Just as an aside, is this the way that would be accepted today as a description?
Like, no, you know, in general, especially in a feature screenplay, you really, the emphasis is on parsimony. And so, so a character description can, you know, often is a couple of lines.
Right.
I know myself actually sort of inspired by this. When I write for TV, I will do a chunkier character description because it helps you suggest what's going to happen after this, after the pilot script. But yeah, in general, if you saw this in a script today, you would think, oh, this guy must be a playwright or something.
Right. Yeah, that's for me, when I read those older scripts, I'm often actually almost jealous that it was the norm back then to use those little literary techniques, because this is more like novelistic, I would say. There's one more great paragraph here. He has the smell of sex about him. Sick sex, repressed sex, lonely sex, but sex nonetheless. He is a raw male force driving forward. Towards what? One cannot tell. Then one looks closer and sees the inevitable. The clock spring cannot be wound continually tighter. As the earth moves toward the sun, Travis Bickle moves towards violence. It sounds like a good pulp novel, you know, like Mickey Spillane, something like that.
So good.
It's really good. Do you have any favorite moments where Travis interacts with other people, like specific scenes that you just, you know, could rewatch many times?
You know what? Okay, so this last time seeing it, I was struck again by what has always been my favorite shot in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So when Travis first walks into the Palatine office to talk to Betsy, he sort of screwed up his courage. He goes in there and they kind of play around, they dance around, and then he finally gets down to what the scene is really about when he says, "I think you're a lonely person."
Mm-hmm.
And I look at you and I see you talking with all these people. I see all these people around you, and I look at you and I see that you're a lonely person. You're a lonely person. And I look at all of this, and he gestures with his hand, and he means all of this on your desk, all these phones means nothing to you. And that moment, the camera pops kind of up, looking down at the desk, in a way that's not sourced. It's not like, because it's kind of straight down, and it's not, and Travis is over in the left corner of the shot, it's not sourced from Travis's point of view or from Betsy's point of view. It's kind of objectively, it's a weirdly objective shot, and it's a crazy, strange, brilliant shot. And because it's kind of objectively just down, all the stuff on the desk and his hand like moving across it, that's the moment you realize that, oh, like, this isn't just Travis's view of this desk. Mm-hmm. It's her view of the desk too. And it's actually what he's saying is true.
Mm-hmm.
And then you come back down and and that's the moment he's broken through to her.
Mm-hmm.
And just that turn in the scene when, you know, Travis stops playing around and gets real with her, and she suddenly realizes he sees something in me that none of these other people see.
Mm-hmm.
It's totally, for me, it's just an exhilarating, exhilarating moment.
That's fascinating. I think there are several shots like that, at least I think, where we see a surface. I think that happens also in the taxi cab office at the beginning. But that sort of aligns our view of the world with Travis's.
Yeah.
Which is, on one hand, it's very sly on Scorsese's part, because he puts us in his head. But this also brings me to this fascinating conundrum of this film, because Travis, in so many ways, is a scary, repugnant character, right? Somebody that we wouldn't like to spend time with, under no circumstances.
Yeah.
Possibly someone that we have spent some time with, maybe in a taxi, you know, like we don't know, right? We don't know. But on a closer look, he's very, very disturbed and disturbing. And yet, of course, in the film, we want to watch him. We want to see what he will do. And this brings me to this whole notion of likability. You know, there's a million books on this. You know, save the cat, character.
Travis does not save that cat.
So he doesn't save the cat, right? I mean, or is there a moment in which he does something that ingratiate, you know, that makes us feel warmer towards him. Like, do you sense those moments where Scorsese and Schrader actually bring us a bit closer to him, warm him up for us a little bit?
That's interesting. I wonder what you think about that. I know for me, I would say the main feeling I have with Travis isn't warmth, really, but it's just fascination.
Fascination.
And this, I mean, everyone talks about likability. What we really want are characters that fascinate us and that make us just grip us and make us want to see, oh my God, what's this guy going to do next? Mm-hmm. It's, we don't have to like him to just be fascinated by the trajectory of this asteroid that's going to collide with something, and we know it's going to collide with something, and how is that going to play out?
Right.
I do also think, though, that, you know, one of the beautiful things about the film is the kind of documentary aspect of it, that you really are seeing, like, New York in the 70s, and it's horrible. And so when Travis is driving through this New York, you're seeing the reality. And I think my reaction when I see that New York is, yeah, this is disgusting. Like, yes, clean this up. Yes, I want that flood to come in, the rain to come in, and just wash all the scum away. And because you're seeing it with Travis, I think you feel it. You feel a certain amount of, is it empathy? Is it sympathy? I don't know. But I know definitely I feel like, every once in a while, Travis says something in that movie. I'm like, yes, I want that too.
Right.
Even though I'm terrified, and actually, I don't know that I don't know that an objective me would really like, the real world me, maybe wouldn't say that, but like
but the you that is watching the film,
yes,
right?
Exactly.
The you that
yes,
is
exactly.
This actually fits perfectly, and I need to quote this review that Pauline Kael wrote of the film when it premiered in 1976. She wrote in the New Yorker of Travis, and I love this phrase. It actually aligns with what you said. She describes Travis, and she says, quote, he hates New York with a biblical fury. It gives off the stench of hell, and its filth and smut obsess him. He manages to get a date with Betsy, Sybil Shepherd, a political campaigner whose blondness and white clothes represent purity to him. But he is so out of touch that he inadvertently offends her, and she won't have anything more to do with him. When he fumblingly asks advice from Wizard, Peter Boyle, an older cab driver, and indicates the pressure building up in him, Wizard doesn't know what he's talking about. Travis becomes sick with loneliness and frustration, and then, like a commando preparing for a raid, he purifies his body and goes into training to kill. And this is the key line. Taxi Driver is a movie in heat, a raw tabloid version of Notes from Underground, the Dostoevsky. Hmm. And we stay with the protagonist's hatreds all the way. I think this is profound. That's sort of for the 2 hours that the movie, you know, is unspooling, we sort of start to share those hatreds of his, like you said, and we know that they have to spill over in some fashion, right? Yeah. There has to be a release. Speaking of release and tension, where would you say that the quote unquote plot or suspense really starts? Like, where is this sort of like first question or the dramatic question or indication that, you know, this may happen, you know, this violence may happen? Where for you the threat of violence like actually begins?
That's a great question.
I have a theory, but I'm curious what you would say. I have one theory.
I mean, there are little moments throughout the whole first 40 minutes of the film suggesting the kind of the capacity of violence in the world, and also these moments where Travis feels like he's getting close to confronting other people. But, you know, I think it's really, for me, that moment when he's being Betsy won't return his calls. He goes back into the office to try to win her back or to yell at her. And he snaps into that karate pose as he's being kicked out of the office.
Right.
And smashes the door. I mean, that's when you know, like, okay, this is like really exploding. But I think that's pretty late in the movie. And maybe is there an earlier thing that you're thinking?
I was thinking of the scene in which one of the cab drivers asks him, "Do you carry a piece?" when he asks him about the gun, because that's actually Travis says that some other cab driver had his ear cut off by a passenger, and then so do you carry a piece, and this is the first time like the famous shotgun in Chekhov, right, that we hear that, oh, maybe you would like, you know, a gun and I can fix it for you. So I think, like, for in a way, this scene for me introduces the possibility that you may want to have a gun.
Yeah.
But later on, and this is fascinating because I sort of forgot about this shift in structure, we have the scene with Martin Scorsese, right?
When this
vile dialogue, you know, where he speaks of his jealousy of his wife, and the Magnum 44, right? Which appears, and this is the second appearance of the gun, let's say, of the theme of the gun, and what I find fascinating, and completely forgot about this, is that in the script, actually, the next scene after the conversation with Marty, the very next scene is the buying of a gun. Like that's the next scene that comes in the script. He goes to this guy called Andy.
Easy Andy.
It's the Easy Andy, and it's almost like, you know, it's almost like a cause and effect. So
he
mentions the you know, Magnum 44.
Yeah,
and Travis immediately goes to buy the gun, which isn't the order in the film. Actually, he buys the gun much later.
Well, it's a little bit later.
A little bit later, right.
What happens in the film, though, between the scene with Scorsese and the buying of the gun? There's a little bit of something there.
It's a very important song. I actually wrote it down. Right after the Martin Scorsese scene, let's say, the Magnum 44 scene, we jump to a scene that is much, much later in the script, which is the conversation with the wizard, where he says that there's this,
oh,
he says, wizard says to him, and this is not in the script, funny thing, he says, you should get laid, which is not in the script. he says it in the movie. And then we come back to Iris, this moment when he pulls on the brakes, and we see Iris for the second time.
Yes.
And then he buys the gun.
That's so good.
So for me, I mean, this is probably the biggest change from the script, because in the script, Iris actually, for her first appearance, is much later. Like she's, wait a second. Yeah, for the first time, I think she's after the conversation with Palantine. In the script, we have the conversation about Magnum, and then immediately buying of the gun. And in the film, it's almost like buying of the gun is the direct consequence of seeing Iris again.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, this time it really struck me that it's interesting because that you say that. I didn't know that's how it was in the script. Mm-hmm. This time that I saw it, it really struck me the clarity of that line between Betsy rejects him. He's at home with all these flowers, and the scent of the flowers is making me ill. I think I have stomach cancer.
Yeah.
It's like, he's obsessed with Betsy. He wants to either have Betsy or kill Betsy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Then, have you seen what a 44 Magnum will do to a woman's face, right? And then, how about asking Andy, do you have a 44 Magnum?
Right.
And it's interesting that they put the scene with Wizard in between there, because it actually suggests, like, you like that guy way more than you do the guy who hears Scorsese in the back and then goes out to buy a gun, because it suggests that Travis is trying to find another way. He's exhausting all his options before he goes out to buy the gun.
Yeah, I didn't think about it.
Very likable, you know.
I didn't think about it. It's that's true.
I mean, it's not very likable, but it's, well, you know, it's you safe. Like it more than the guy who, like, who hears like Scorsese and then goes out and buys a gun, the guy who hears Scorsese and is like, hey, I got problems. Maybe the wisest person I know can help me. And he's got nothing.
Right.
And
right.
then to see Iris in there is so good too, because it's like in the mix of that psychology, and then there's the buying of the guns. You know?
I didn't think about it, but I think I completely agree. And the kicker is that in the screenplay, the conversation with the wizard actually comes right after he kills the guy in the deli. So this is actually post immediately. It's actually the next scene. So he's already a killer. And actually, when I was reading the script, because this time I first reread it and then I rewatched the film, I was reading the script and I felt like, because you know he just killed the guy at the deli, and then Charlie T, this other cab driver, greets him and says, "Hiya, killer," in the script. And I felt like, does he know that he killed the guy? Like what?
Right.
But by moving the scene to way earlier in the film, as you mentioned, this Hiya Killer is still there, but it's just like a joke. You know, it's no longer confusing.
That's great. But what about that scene in the deli? What's so great about the scene in the deli is that like he sees what's happening. The old Travis would have just ignored it.
Right.
And you see him in the store thinking, I should just ignore this. And then he's like, no, wait, I'm the new Travis.
Right.
And going in there and doing something really noble and good.
Or doing something like almost like that would be called noble in the world of the Western, which I guess, you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure,
like the searchers, right?
Yeah,
he there's this danger, right? And he reacts with a gun.
Yes.
The way a Western hero would react, right? Yeah. And actually, it's funny because Quentin Tarantino, who is a big fan of the film, he wrote in his book called Cinema Speculation that the whole film is a variation on The Searchers, where, you know, basically with De Niro as the sort of a John Wayne character who wants to save Jodie Foster, the way John Wayne wanted to, quote-unquote, save Natalie Wood from Native Americans in The Searchers. And I guess, in a way, Travis does live in a black-and-white world like that, right? Or does he live in a Western, or does
know.
He live in the Old Testament? Like, what is his like?
Well, maybe it's a little bit of both, you know. Mm. Maybe there's a version of Travis who wants to be calling down the plagues upon Egypt, and there's a version of Travis that wants to be, wants to be the lawman in the Wild West.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if it's quite fair to say that Travis is. I don't think Travis is John Wayne, actually. Mm-hmm. I think Travis doesn't know if he's John. Travis is like he wants to be John Wayne, but he's not in a Western world. Mm-hmm. His world isn't a Western world.
Right.
His world is so gray, and he's so caught up in the filth of it that like John Wayne doesn't go to porno theaters all night every night. John Wayne doesn't live so much in that seedy world that the only place he can bring a date is to a porno theater. And that's what makes Travis so interesting, is that he has this strain in him that's like almost like Old Testament puritanical. But the one that he wants to cleanse and get rid of and blow away is himself.
It's himself.
Or some mirror version of himself.
Right. That gets literalized at the end when he puts fingers to his forehead.
Yeah, exactly.
He mimics.
Exactly. Because he's trying to destroy himself, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's trying to kind of go out in a blast of meaning, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that he's discovered the meaning of his life, and it's going to finally, like, he's going to burn himself on up in this meaningful final gesture.
I just thought of something. That I think that part of this, I don't want to say warming up to Travis, but the way that we feel for him, despite everything that he does, is that Schrader and Scorsese are very smart in playing the quote unquote class differences or the class card between Travis and Betsy,
yeah,
and Tom, who is by the weirdest casting ever. Like, I always like, what does Albert Brooks do in a Martin Scorsese film? But I think there is this sort of class contempt that the that the character of Tom definitely has for the likes of Travis, and Travis, I think Betsy shares in that a little bit. I was struck by the phrase in the script when Schrader introduces Tom and Betsy through Travis's eyes, of course, and he says, "These are America's chosen youth, healthy, energetic, well-groomed, attractive, all recruited from the bucolic fields of Massachusetts and Connecticut," right? So it's like these are like H.G. Wells, you know, the Eloys, you know, they are the rich, the privileged,
yeah.
And Travis is obviously not, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he got conscripted into the army, he fought, he didn't have a way of buying himself out of that, right? So maybe it's the thing that we also feel a little bit for the underdog, that, you know, that Travis is simply poorer. I don't know, like a pariah or something.
It's not an accident that he's always separated from that office by the glass.
Right.
I mean, that's like, yeah, he wants to be on the other side of that window.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Sort of, but he also wants to smash the window and destroy the office and everything mm-hmm. that's inside. And that's just like, yeah. And they don't want him, they want those windows. It's so interesting. Like, they want those big clear windows to make it look like anyone can come in, but really it's those windows are also to keep people out, people like Travis.
That's Palantine's demagogic ways. I mean, he says that he's the man of the people, you know, see that there's such a gulf between him and Travis. But I think there's also, do you remember the scene with the record, with the Kris Kristofferson record? I think this is brilliant. Like, how do you read it? Like this, what is about this whole, you remind me the guy from the song, and then he buys the record. He doesn't even unseal it. Like, it's still in the foil, right?
Yeah.
And she says in a very contemptuous way, when he, you know, at the end of the date, please just keep the record.
Yeah.
And she says, I already have it.
I already got it.
Right? Like, that's also like class contempt a little bit, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's really interesting to think that, like, these are the two worlds that they live in are so distant from each other that, like, she's referencing the lyrics to a song that he's never heard and never heard of, and that he has no way of even accessing.
Yeah.
He has no record player.
He lies that he has a broken record player, but
right.
we know that
That's
we doesn't
right.
have
That's
the right. record player. So she lives and she says, "Oh, I cannot live without music."
Yeah.
Right. So she's in this world of culture, and his only frame of reference to culture is those porn theaters that he visits, right?
Yeah.
And he takes her, I guess, to the one that's at tiny bit more respectable than the
yeah, it seems
than the
nicer
others.
Than the one that, where they don't have chuckles or jujubes.
Yeah, 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 yeah. What about the character of Tom? Like, what? That I have to say, I love this movie. I think it's a masterpiece. But I always wonder about the casting of Albert Brooks.
Yeah,
this. Like,
it's a big hiccup for me. Uh-huh. Always. I also every time it feels a little strange. But part of that though is that scene, the first scene with Tom and Betsy. So Travis, one of the amazing things about the movie is that Travis is in every single scene of the movie, except for two.
Right.
The first one is the scene between Tom and Betsy in the office.
Right.
So it's the first time in the movie you've ever been someplace without Travis taking you there. And so you're with the two of them for quite a long scene.
Mm-hmm.
And only at the end do they sort of fib a little bit, and she notices Travis watching outside, so it's trying to fake that actually this scene was maybe through Travis's POV, even though it wasn't shot that way. And so there's that scene, and then there's the scene later with with Iris and Sport when they're dancing.
Right.
That scene also, at the end of the scene, I think the camera comes down and we see that Travis is like in the street outside.
Okay.
As a kind of a way of trying to glue that into Travis's perspective. Mm-hmm. But so I think part of the hiccup of the Albert Brooks scene is that you're cutting, the first time you're cutting away from Travis, you're cutting to Albert Brooks. And so it intensifies, or you're cutting to Betsy, I guess, and then Albert Brooks, but it sort of intensifies the disconnect between those two worlds, you know?
Yeah, I always felt like tiny, tiny incongruous note, you know, because Albert Brooks is actually Albert Brooks in the film, you know, like he's doing this sort of like when he says like with the pins, you know, like we are the people, we are the people. That almost sounds like a line from Albert Brooks' film. He's just being funny. By the way, Tom in the script, which I also completely forgot about, was written as a much bigger guy. Like he actually towers over Travis when he throws him out, he towers physically over him, which is not the case with Albert Brooks.
Yeah.
So it's there was a different change here. What about Iris? We finally need to address
Iris,
this character. She's there hovering sort of on the outskirts of the story, and yet she's completely central to the story.
Yeah,
right? in so many ways.
Yeah, it's amazing the way that that character just sort of peeks into the movie a couple of times, and then. Yeah. And yet manages at the end to become the whole focus of everything.
Right,
the film is very strange. Just the first time you see her, and she's in the back of the cab, and just getting pulled out. But like, what anchors it is that $20 bill, you know? And like, because of the crumpled bill, like, somehow that sticks with you. In a way that it signals that this is not just another weird fare that Kravis is getting. It's like,
but how brilliant is that? It's like using just a little object. I mean, from the screenwriting point of view, right? A very, very everyday object, completely connected to his work. But it becomes a sort of a talisman.
Yeah.
That he looks at it and we know what it means. It's like this tiny little crumb.
Yes.
That, you know. Yeah. That was left by, well, not by Iris herself, but in a way by her, right?
Yeah. And he gives it, when he goes to see Iris, he gives it back to the kind of doorman in the hotel.
Yes. Like, I don't want your dirty money.
Exactly, oh, yeah, it's, yeah,
it's,
yeah.
It's incredible.
Exactly,
it's incredible.
Exactly. And just the idea also that, like, that money, he senses that there's something different about that $20 bill than all the other 20s that are in his in that cigar box that he carries, you know? And so he also, like, he knows that this is dirty money or means something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so he doesn't mix it in with the others. He keeps it crumpled.
Right. Yeah, because I also, again, I completely forgot about this. In the script, there's this line where Betsy hears how much Travis works. He says that he works those long shifts. And she says, oh, you must be rich then. Which I guess is just a sign of how out of touch she is. Like that, you know, that he will actually make a lot of money.
Yeah.
But actually, there's the scene, and it's kept in the film, but a little bit differently, with the meter going on. When we see, you know, those numbers, like $1,
$2. Yeah.
And I don't know what it meant for Scorsese. Like, for him, probably it was just cool visually. But on some level, I think it's also about this sort of, I hate to use those big words, but about capitalism, you know? Like, that basically every person that enters this taxi is translated into money in a strange way.
I found, you know, it's interesting you say that. Because this last time I was seeing it, I sort of noticed this really for the first time that, like, in a sense, you know, all of Travis's interactions are mediated by money. Like, he's
money.
Guy. Mm-hmm. He interacts with people in the back of the cab because they pay him for this. And that's, and you know, visually you understand it through the mirror, you know, his eyes in the mirror and the people sort of separated visually in that way. But that, like, really all of his interactions are financial. Like, he only ever sees people if it's mediated by money. And that's what's so interesting about that dollar bill, is that that's the first time that there's this money, but he's not accepting that as like a payment for his social interaction.
Totally,
you know?
Totally. That's I didn't think about this. Yeah.
And then
yeah.
Iris, of course, and then of course when he goes to Iris and that transaction, just to get to Iris, he's got to pay. Charlie's got to pay the right. doorman. He's got to pay for the hotel. He's got to pay her. And it's like, there is this sense in which when he finally gets into the room with Iris, you realize like, oh, he and himself is kind of a like a monetized instrument of society in the same way that Iris is this monetized instrument of society. And there's this real kind of rhyme between those, the two of them, that I never noticed that before.
But, right. But I completely agree. I didn't think about this, but in a way, Travis, the only way that Travis has to enter any sort of interaction is by paying money as well. Because yeah. when he pays, you know, for a ticket in a porn theater, he also pays for this moment of warped intimacy, but also of this, you know, communal moment when he's with the other, you know, viewers. Yeah, like, that's yeah, the only yeah. way that he can do it.
Or at the concession stand. In probably, I think, is that the second scene in the movie or the third scene in the movie?
Something
it's
like that.
It's like when he's like, he just wants to talk to a person.
Yeah.
And the only way to do it is to try to chat with the girl at the concession stand.
And of course, she's completely unresponsive because, you know, Travis is like 100th client this day that probably does the same thing. I mean, he's the creep.
Yeah,
that tries,
exactly.
You know, to...
Exactly. And I think he kind of knows it too. And like, and he apologizes for being the creep by buying more and more candy and junk and stuff. I mean, you've been there, haven't you?
Right.
I've been there.
Right, of course.
That's the thing, you recognize that, like, that
the loneliness.
Pain.
The
yeah,
loneliness.
The loneliness and, like, mm-hmm. the self, like, he hates himself for hitting, he's not even hitting on her. He hates himself for trying to converse with this mm-hmm. girl at the concession stand, and yet that's all he's got, and he's just got to keep doing it.
There's a wonderful description in the script, which I don't think it actually made it into the film as such, although I think the film totally conveys it. There's a moment when he looks through his taxi window, and the description reads like this. We see New York's nightlife as Travis sees it. Camera tracks down midtown sidewalks in slightly slow motion. There we see couples walking in slow motion, young couples, middle-aged couples, old couples, hookers and Johns, girlfriends, boyfriends, business friends, the whole world matched up in pairs, and Travis left wandering alone in the nights. In the night, and one more sentence. Others would notice the breasts, the asses, the faces, but not Travis. He notices the girl's hand that wraps the hair on her boyfriend's neck, the hand that hangs lightly on his shoulder, the nuzzling kiss in the air. That's exactly what the film is about. Although I don't think, we don't have a scene like
this
in the film.
There is actually, no, there is, that moment is there.
Okay.
It's not as long as this. But do you remember, okay, so this is after the midpoint of the film. It's just before Travis and the television and that kind of long, music video, kind of strange sequence of the television.
Oh, yeah.
But so,
with the dancing show? Or?
Yeah, the dancing show. So in this is, it's such a good, it's so good. So he's bought the weapons, and now he's driving, and now he's bought the weapons, and he's driving along, and he sees it's a girl in like kind of a white shirt and or their arm around a boyfriend, and there's another couple he sees there as he's driving, and then he's in his apartment and he's watching on, and everything he's watching on TV is all couples.
Couples.
And there's a love scene,
right,
like, you know,
treasure.
I love, it's a soap opera, I love you. And then there's that
okay.
that crazy like Western music with the dancing couples, and then he finally kicks over the TV.
Right.
But actually that, like, I don't remember it being so long, but it's really long.
It's long.
That's long. Him watching the TV and you really feel it. But, you know, to me, that was like the moment, like he's bought the weapons. He's looking for the thing that what's he going to do to make meaning of his life? Actually, the thing that he wants is just to have his arm around somebody.
Yeah. This know? Closeness. And this tells you, actually, it's fascinating that you mentioned it, because this tells you of how Scorsese, I think, felt this character more than Schrader, because the moment with the TV is in the script, but the show is described completely differently. It's the TV is broadcasting Rock Time, a late afternoon local teenage dance and rock show. On screen, young teeny boppers are dancing, and the TV cameraman, as any devotee of the genre knows, is relentlessly zooming in on their firm young breasts, fannies, and crotches, a sensibility which reflects Travis's own. This is not in the film.
It's the opposite of that, actually.
It's the thing with the craving for intimacy. Yeah. I
love that because it also reveals what Schrader's done with his afternoons, how he's spent his afternoon. Yes.
Oh, I think there's lots of Schrader here, in places that that are darker than we would like to. to think. But let's come back to Iris just for one moment, because I find it completely fascinating that, you know, Jodie Foster has really those two scenes with De Niro. I mean, dialogue scenes, because I you know, the first encounters are just like, you know, those beacons, moments. You know, she's there, you know, she's there. She's maybe in peril. She is in peril, actually. She's underage. She's 12 and a half years old in the film. That's what sport says. But those two dialogue scenes, one, you know, this awkward sexual encounter, but then there's this wonderful scene, probably in some way my favorite scene in the movie, the breakfast scene, which is like, suddenly you see her in the good daylight, you know, she's just this teenager with you know, this freshness and awkwardness and, you know, funny things that she says just simply as a teenage girl. And you have Travis with all the horrible things that we know about him.
Yeah.
And yet you know that he cares about her, that he really wants to save her. He doesn't want to harm her. Like, that's probably the only character in the film that he really wants to protect.
Yeah.
Tell me how you see this scene. It's a pretty long scene. It's like a pretty long dialogue scene.
But it's also very interesting because it's paired. Yeah, it's paired with the earlier cafe scene with him and Betsy, you know?
Right,
and so, which has a very different, well, maybe the opposite energy, right? You know? Yeah, it's an amazing scene because it's like you sense that kind of almost fatherly concern with her, and that he has no idea what to do and how to get through to her, and also that, like, somehow he's found the one person in this city who's like him.
Mm.
You know, I mean, to me,
as lost, as lonely.
Yeah, who's just as like messed up as he is. You know, I love when she says, "Boy, you know, I think you're as weird as I am."
Right, you know, right. Like, there's this strange resemblance, right?
Yeah,
between them.
Yeah.
And just to give our listeners the idea of just how profoundly the structure is changed regarding to Iris, I just remembered, because I forgot, the first glimpse of Iris that we get in the script is actually after Travis starts to work out, after he, like, it's
after
it's,
the midpoint.
It's dead late. It's dead late in the script. Wow. He's already have the gun. He spot the gun. He says that I need to shape up.
Yep.
We see him shooting, you know, at the shooting range, and then the next scene is the first, the $20 bill. So that's pretty. Pretty late.
Oh, interesting. Yeah,
that's very late.
Well, because the buying of the guns is right in the middle of the film.
Yeah.
It's really the exact midpoint. And so that's late.
So I have no idea.
But you know, it's very brave. It's a very brave thing to introduce that character so early in the film and trust that the viewer is going to remember her.
Remember her.
You know, even with that other hit just before the midpoint, which is just a moment.
Right.
Trust that we're going to remember her enough to follow that thread through the movie.
Well, the bill helps us with this, right?
Yes,
the $20 bill.
Yeah, it does.
That's
it does.
The talisman that sort of carries us through.
What about that scene when he goes up into the room with Iris? Don't you get the feeling in that scene that he's disgusted by the idea of having sex with her, but he kind of like does want to have sex with her?
That's also very interesting, because I think that Schrader has a little bit different take and Scorsese has a bit different take. In the text, it's very clear. It says that Travis never had sex before with anyone. It says that this is his first sexual encounter.
Wow.
So this is a major piece of information.
Yes. Which actually, is, you know, it's interesting because I watching again this time, I had this thought, like, oh, I wonder if Travis is a virgin.
So he, according to the text, he is.
Yeah.
This is not something that we learn from the movie. I think that he's genuinely scared of any intimacy, really.
Yeah.
I mean, we had the scene in the porn theater, which is like a like the ultimate parody of a date. I mean it's the probably the worst date in the history of movies. I mean, I cannot really think of a more awkward date than this one,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So I think that here, when he has her so close and the sexual encounter becomes a possibility,
yeah.
Actually is assumed to happen, I think he's more scared, I think, than in the script. That's my basic feeling. But also, I think that the movie wisely counts on our sort of shock value, because you know, mm-hmm. we know that she is an underage girl, we know that she's played by a young actress,
yeah.
and there's this sort of like, okay, how far is this, you know, going to go, and it goes I would say it goes pretty
she's
far.
So you know, it's interesting because she's so frank about everything,
yeah.
you know, and that like that I think like helps with that plot line so much, because she doesn't give off the feeling of like a vulnerable girl who needs to be saved.
Mm-hmm,
there's
mm-hmm.
kind of this like disconnect between the kind of hard exterior and what we know to be the case just because she's 12.
That's fantastic, because she is in no way a stereotypical victim.
Yeah,
you know, like there's no like this there's no glow around her, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, there's this innocent, you know, like no, we I mean, we know that she has been violated, and we know that, you know, her life is completely, you know, off the tracks,
yeah,
and stuff.
Yeah.
But she's not sentimentalized as this
yeah.
frail creature, you know, yeah. which would be the case in this sort of pre-modern Dickensian world, you mm-hmm. know, where we had,
yeah,
you know, like
for sure.
those.
The waif.
Yeah, the waifs, you know, and all those girls, you know, also victims of you know, of male violence, but they were always impeccably pure, angelic, and sentimentalized. And here she's vulgar. She's,
yeah.
you know, she's very, and yet, I think it's a fantastic performance, because you like
yeah.
her, like you like her smartness. You like that, you know, she's completely like on par with Travis. Like
yeah,
she's
yeah.
probably, for all we know, she's like even more experienced than Travis. Like she definitely interacted with people more, I think, that
yeah,
he
for
did.
Sure. Well, she can talk circles around him. She's smarter than he is.
Right.
Travis is not that smart.
Yeah.
You know, and he's not very articulate, and so. You know, when you get into these scenes, she's able to just explain everything.
Yeah.
And Travis struggles to explain to her like what he's seeing, which is that like this is wrong, you know?
Yeah. And what I love, and this is something that is almost like historical value to this film, which that she is dressed like this hippie hooker, which is exactly what it says in the script, that she has those hippie paraphernalia, like, you know, the hat, the beads, the
yeah.
And we can tell
the sunglasses, the many different pairs of sunglasses.
Yeah, and she says there's this commune in Virginia, maybe I will go there, right?
That's right.
And we realize that this is like the tail end, like the rotten tail end of counterculture, right?
Yeah.
That it's all burnt.
Yeah.
Like it's not there anymore.
Yes.
But she's there as this sort of latecomer victim of this whole, you know, like promiscuity or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And this is also something that I didn't understand about New York before I went there, that actually Travis travels the whole length of the island of Manhattan, because she's in Lower East Side,
yeah.
Tompkins Park,
yeah.
the hippie area,
yeah.
and Harlem is way.
Yeah,
way up.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's like, you know, he's covering the whole.
Yeah, but I think he also goes to Bronx,
right.
and to Brooklyn too. I mean, that's like anytime, anywhere, right?
Anytime, anywhere.
Anytime,
exactly.
anywhere. Yeah, I love this in that scene when she's like, and she talks about the commune in Vermont. He's like, I saw that in a magazine once. It looks pretty dirty.
Looks pretty dirty.
But like,
exactly.
you know, he saw it in a porno magazine. It was some sort of orgy.
Exactly.
In you know, commune orgy or something.
Commune orgy. Exactly. Exactly.
I love that.
When he says that it's kind of dirty, you also think back to his apartment, you know, which is
yeah,
filthy.
Right.
Filthy.
Yeah, yeah,
you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And even
exactly.
his eating habits. I mean, it's another thing, you know, when he does this little bowl of bread, maple syrup,
It's bread. No, it's not maple syrup. It's schnapps.
It's schnapps.
It's,
okay.
So it's bread, sugar, schnapps, sugar. And milk.
But then Iris also sprinkles some sugar on her jelly sandwich,
She puts so much jelly and so much sugar. Yeah, it's great. It's really, really good. It's really good. Just like the junk, you know?
Yeah.
And like that's like just so much part of the texture of that world.
They are both like a brother and sister in a way, like just eating junk, being like, you know, on the fringes of society. In a different world, they could be probably, you know, just siblings, you know?
Yeah, I know. It's really interesting. There's also something, you know, this is something I thought this time also. The fact that Travis, that De Niro is so handsome and that Jodie Foster is so beautiful, you know, also Sybil Shepherd,
yeah.
Like that, just like, we don't think about this very often because it seems so like pedestrian, but the fact that Travis Bickle is really, really good looking is part of what makes this movie work.
Absolutely.
It's just like, we want to look at his face.
Absolutely.
You know, partly because he's the acting is amazing, partly because he's just handsome. And the when Jodie Foster is so beautiful and so fresh that, you know, just visually, you immediately have the sense that Travis doesn't really belong in this world because he's too good looking for this world, and she's too good looking to be in this world, you know?
And this is something that's also in the script, like said many times, that, you know, he can light up the room with his smile, that there is this sexual, like, energy to him. So, and they are the prettiest people in the movie. I mean, you know, no one else in the movie looks as good as them. I will just read a brief sentence from the Quentin Tarantino book, Cinema Speculation, in which he fantasizes another version of Taxi Driver, directed by Brian De Palma, who actually read the script first and he considered making the film, but then he passed it on to Martin Scorsese. Okay, so this is Quentin Tarantino, quote, I think it's entirely doubtful De Palma would have empathized with Travis Bickle the way Schrader does and the way Scorsese and De Niro did. With the film Martin Scorsese made, when you watch Taxi Driver, you become Travis Bickle. Mm-hmm. Regardless of whether or not you empathize or sympathize with the rituals of Travis's existence, you observe them. And in observing them, you come to understand them. And when you understand this lonely man, he stops being a monster, if he ever was one to begin with. Scorsese, Schrader, and De Niro make you witness a man from that man's perspective. I'd speculate when Brian De Palma first read Schrader's manuscript, he didn't see it as a first-person diary dream that Schrader intended. I'd bet De Palma's first reaction would have been along the lines of, oh, great, this can be my repulsion. So the Polanski the Polanski film, which, you know, brings us very close to a very, very, very disturbed young woman. Empathy is the crucial word. I think that that both Scorsese and Schrader feel it probably towards the end. And maybe we should discuss that Final Massacre. Like, what's
the Final Massacre? Yeah,
like what's your take on it? The massacre, and of course the idyllic aftermath, right? Everything's fine.
Yeah.
Like Betsy is in his car.
Yeah.
There's this ongoing conversation. Is it real or is it just imagined? What is your take on the ending of Taxi Driver?
Well, I love the ending. I love the ending. I think it's great. You know, for me, it was really interesting. Again, like this last time seeing it, I never quite realized just how high on amphetamines Travis was for the last 20 minutes of the movie.
Like literally.
High on amphetamines. So like, you know, it's about, let's see, at the midpoint he buys the guns. About 15 minutes later, he is, the Mohawk is revealed. Mm-hmm. He takes amphetamines there. He tries to kill the senator. It fails. He goes back to his apartment and he takes a whole bunch more amphetamines and washes them down with beer. And then he immediately goes to Iris. And there's some undercranking of the camera and also the performance. He's totally tweaked out.
Mm-hmm.
And it just like it never occurred to me before. But he's totally high out of his mind.
Right, I never thought about this. Right, that's true. Maybe because we see him earlier, like with those. I don't know what those pills are.
Yeah, I think those are amphetamines.
Amphetamines. Yeah. Okay, okay.
And that's, I think, how he's staying awake to do his taxi driving. But yeah, he gets clean in the midpoint, and then just before he goes into combat, kind of he takes a dose and then takes a huge dose. So I don't know. That was like, it's an observation that I noticed this time. To me, it's really, really strange how incredibly satisfying the end of that movie is for me. That massacre, it really feels like Travis has found his purpose in life.
Mm-hmm. However disturbing, yeah, but that's true. I mean, that's true. This is where a movie brings us. I mean, it brings us to the kind of closure that Travis basically dreamt for himself, right?
And like, I really, you know, there's this, I think throughout the whole, from minute 45, I think you sense that Travis is going to do something horrible. Mm-hmm. He's going to do something really violent. It's going to be directed somewhere that we're now building to a big blast. And right at minute 60, he's buying the guns and he's practicing on the range and he's getting fit, you know? And, you know, then he's in the porno theater, like at minute 62 or something, saying, you know, an idea has been brewing for a long time. And that's when he thinks he's going to kill the senator. But, you know, you have this feeling like maybe he's going to kill Betsy. Maybe he's going to kill the senator. Mm-hmm. And maybe he's going to find some sort of miraculously fruitful way to channel all that rage, that volcano of rage. Mm-hmm. And somehow he does. Somehow it really feels like when he goes and he kills those gangsters and frees Iris, even though Iris, like, she's not happy at all. He's begging, don't kill him. It feels so good and so right and so cathartic.
Right. It gives you this sort of feeling of justice has been done, you know, like that, that, you know, you basically, it's almost like, well, in the Palmas, The Untouchables, you know, when Elliot Ness finally pushes that guy off the roof, you know, who, you know, threatened his family and stuff.
Yeah.
You feel satisfied. I mean, this is exactly what this
is. But, you know, this is a little bit different because there's no connection between Charlie and Travis. Like, you know, those pimps
aren't
threatening Travis in any way. They have nothing against him. He has no relationship with them, really.
They are only actors in his own morality play.
Yeah, you know, that he concocted. Yeah. But like, and yet somehow it works. It's really...
But you know what's? I never thought about this. Maybe this is, you know, a good thing towards the conclusion. When I ask myself, I rewatched the film today, right? And I finished the film and I ask myself, will Travis kill again? Will he do it?
Yeah.
My deepest sense is that he will not. That,
yes,
that, you know that yes. something was cleansed of his sister. And I don't know what that says, like, about people and me and this movie, but the movie suggests that something... as in the rain flushing out of the dirt, that something was cleansed.
Well, it's really interesting because it's like part of that, I think, is him putting his hands to his head and saying and going,
right,
like the suicide attempt, because it really feels like, oh, metaphorically, this Travis is dying, you know, and the
blood streaming.
Yeah, he's got the blood, and then also going from Mohawk Travis, which is so like what a visually strong image.
Yeah.
Like, he became someone else for a brief period.
Visually,
too, exactly. Now that person has died, and now, like, he's kind of reborn as a normal
Robert guy. De Niro.
As Robert De Niro, right. And that scene with Betsy at the end, this time watching it through, I got that scene, I think, really for the first time, and really, like, I think it's totally amazing that... You know, Betsy in that rear view mirror, we sense that she still wants Travis. She still needs Travis.
Mm-hmm.
And when Travis doesn't charge her, and you realize, like, she's got nothing on him. He's right. Like, he is, the tables have been turned in a sense, like at the beginning of the movie, Betsy represented everything that he wanted, and he was a supplicant,
right.
You know, going there to beg her to go have coffee with him.
Right.
You know, sending flowers. And now at the end, we have the sense of a man who has...
Self-possessed.
Like, yeah, exactly. Right. He mm-hmm. doesn't need anything from her anymore. He doesn't really need anything from the world anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Like the demon has been cleansed mm-hmm. and...
That's very Dostoevskian, I guess, in some fashion. There's, you know, for me, we talked a little bit earlier about this great hunger that Travis has for, like, intimacy, for real intimacy. And we talked briefly before we started this about the conversation, the film by Coppola.
Yeah.
We could do another episode just about that. But there's this, I think this, on deepest level, both unites Harry, Cole, and Travis. And it also is the difference that they both crave this intimacy. Yeah. There's this moment when Harry flashes back to this tiny little moment when Cindy Williams touches the forehead of Frederick Forrest,
mm-hmm.
Fixing his glasses or something. Very tender little gesture. And this is the gesture that Harry remembers the most about this whole conversation.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, Harry at the end of the film is completely destroyed, right? Yeah. There's no sense,
yes,
like,
yes,
you know, now I'm at peace with the world, however screwed up the means, you know, of that peace, where he's destroyed by his own obsession, profession, everything, I guess. I have one more question.
I think what you're saying is that Taxi Driver is a really happy movie.
But I'm scared by what I'm saying. Like, what am I saying? Like,
it's very interesting. Yeah. I was thinking also mm-hmm. about, you know, Schrader and his sort of history as a film
mm-hmm.
professor, I guess, or a film student, and those the films of Bresson and those other sort of transcendental films where it really, like, they stay very flat.
Mm-hmm.
Until the end, and there's this great outpouring of emotion, you know, and in some sense, Taxi Driver, like, this is, like, in the American model, manages to do something very similar. It's a very, very hard mm-hmm. magic trick, but somehow, you know, you have that feeling that that this sort of burst of violence at the end really is like the culmination of the whole movie.
I think that's his absolute, like, obsession. I mean, over the years, he proved that he, you know, he, unfortunately, I think this is probably the only time that it, like, works fully, and I don't question it, even though probably I should. First Reformed is another film that I respect, and I feel that, like, it got to a very similar place, but I don't think it's as intense as this.
Yeah, I agree.
But yeah, I think this is something that Schrader sort of comes back to this idea of cleansing through violence. I would like to pick your brains because I do this with my students, and we try to write a short log line for a film that we just watched. So this morning I did this exercise with a Taxi Driver.
Great.
And I wrote a log line for the Taxi Driver. Tell me what's wrong with it, or is it like this is it. So we can read it to
Should I read it out loud?
Yes.
Travis Bickle, a young and deeply alienated Vietnam vet, takes up a job driving a night taxi in New York City's most dangerous districts. Disgusted with what he perceives as the ultimate moral decay of the city around him, he first tries to date a privileged political activist, then befriends an underage prostitute, whose saving fast becomes his murderous obsession.
What do you say?
I think that's really good.
Oh, okay. I'm glad. Well, what would you say? What's the most important thing when you prepare a logline to sell your story? And this is, I hope that, you know, our conversation will be listened to by young screenwriters and people who are trying. What's the main objective when you prepare a logline for your
stories? Well, I would say, you know, with any kind of pitch or any kind of story, the most important thing is knowing who is your main character,
right?
And what is he or she trying to do? What is the quest right, or right. the goal for the film?
Right. You know? So we could switch emphasis in a text like this to something else, like violence, for example, you think, or
the problem with Taxi Driver is that Travis, what is Travis going for?
Right.
I don't know. I mean, well, I do know. I mean, he's trying to find meaning in his life.
Right.
You know, he's trying to convince himself that he exists and that his life
tough sell
can be meaningful.
right.
Yeah. I mean, you know, probably today this would be like you'd say a deeply felt indie about an alienated cab driver and the dark world that he inhabits.
Okay.
And you would, it would be very specialty fair.
Okay. So you need to like target the specific audience and say that this will be like a specialty interest.
Yes. Okay. I think so. Because there are still films like this being made. But they're not big budget, and they're not released like Taxi Drivers. I mean, what's kind of amazing is that everyone went to the theater to see Taxi Driver.
Right. That it was the movie of the moment, right?
Yeah.
Which, this part, I mean, I can imagine this film being written. I can imagine this film being made. I cannot imagine this film saturating the culture the way that that Taxi Driver...
Or making a star out of this main character. Yeah, it's hard to imagine.
Andrew, this was a pleasure. It was fantastic experience for me, and thank you so much for agreeing to do this.
Oh, for me too. This is awesome. This is so great. This is my first ever podcast, and so this is a great first experience.
Thank you so much, and we all keep our fingers crossed for the strike and for the conclusion of
it.
And hopefully very soon the members of your guild will be back at their, I was about to say typewriters.
It's no longer a typewriter. Yeah, sure.
And you will be creating wonderful stories for all of us. This was a pleasure and an honor. Thank you so much, and hopefully see you soon.
Thank you. This is great.